Good morning and welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show. I'm Amy Otto, joined by Lee Cantor. Good morning, Lee.
Good morning, Miss Amy. How are you doing this fine Atlanta spring day, finally?
Yes, I love it. You know, I'm good. I attended a breakfast meeting this morning about social media, and it's everywhere.
You noticed?
It's everywhere. People are listening to podcasts. People are going on Twitter, and Facebook.
Twittering.
So all of our listeners, social media is definitely the way to go. We're glad you're listening, and we're glad you're getting a great show this morning, actually. A little bit different. When people think of business, oftentimes they don't think of healthcare, and boy, it's big business, especially in Atlanta. Very privileged this morning to have with us Dr. Mark Perlow, who is with the Georgia Reproductive Specialist. Welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show.
Good morning.
Dr. Perlow, we understand that fertility is a big issue, especially with folks in their biological clocks not stopping. Just kind of walk us through a little bit about what y'all do and what might make you different.
Well, one of the things that I think is unique is that we're a full-service infertility shop. We'll do the basic evaluation history and then offer either simple techniques, if that's what it takes, or the more advanced reproductive technologies. But we're finding out that in this day and age, with the economy where it is, with people losing their jobs, they're often able to find out what's wrong, but they don't have insurance coverage to actually get the treatment they need, and they're fearing the time on their biological clock.
Yeah, because it doesn't stop, even though you might not have insurance.
The biological clock doesn't care if there's a downturn in the economy.
How are celebrities always able to get pregnant, like 45, 50? How do they pull that off?
Well, they go in the back entrance to the fertility clinic
right,
and get
a
donor
special
eggs.
Room. Right, exactly. Is that where that happens?
Right.
So what are some of the things that you're doing with your clinic and some of the creative strategies that you are implementing to help folks?
Well, our concern was that we were seeing patients less and less able to afford treatment and losing coverage. So we looked at problems with this high cost, and we found that often insurance companies were covering some treatments, but they were often not the most effective, or they would cover a treatment that would put the patient at risk for an octomom situation. And we figured IVF with transfer of one or two embryos is about the safest way to go. So we revised our pricing so that the couple can pay for one cycle. And we have no extra fees. There are no hidden fees along the way for different parts of treatment. And if the treatment doesn't work, there's a second cycle that is totally free. And this can save them up to 70% of the cost of going through IVF treatment. The other thing that it does is frequently someone will try once and they haven't gotten pregnant and they feel they want to do another try and they're kind of hooked on it. In this situation, people who haven't had a try at this kind of a therapy can get in and they know it's going to cost them right up front. They're not going to be nickeled and dimed along the way, so to speak.
Can you speak a little bit for people who aren't educated about IVF? Like, what is a procedure? Prospect for this, and what does it look like if they decide to give it a try?
Well, if the fallopian tubes are damaged, if there's a very low sperm count, if there's a situation where the couple is at risk for having a child with sickle cell disease or cystic fibrosis, they could choose IVF to bypass the problem and check the embryo before putting it in to make sure that it's not affected. But the process involves the woman taking injections for a 2 to 3 week period, harvesting eggs, mixing them with the sperm, growing them into the lab, and as opposed to what happened in California, again, we'd put back anywhere from one to three embryos, depending on how many attempts and how old the person is.
Now, you mentioned the octomom lady. Now, what would be the rationale of putting in that many? Is that just increase your chances? Like, she couldn't have been shooting for eight.
Criminal stupidity is the only explanation for that kind of treatment.
Really, there's no good reason to have done it that way.
No, I have a number of competitors in Atlanta. And we're lucky here. We don't have any of the programs in Atlanta that would stoop to that type of treatment.
Yeah, boy, that's a whole nother show, Lee.
So they're just shooting for eight then? That's why they're doing that?
No, I don't think so. I think that particular program had very low pregnancy rates. and the mother wanted to go ahead, and they rarely had success in this program other than actually with this one patient. And they
so that just increases your chances, obviously. The more you put in there, then the higher the probability that something is going to stick and then the lady will get pregnant?
Actually, not really. When you look at the statistics, if you define success as one child at home, one in two embryos are the best. If you decide success is one or twins, then transferring two embryos is actually more successful than transferring three. Uh-huh. The success rate tends to go down, except in select cases, the woman who's older than 40, the one who's been through multiple IVF failures.
I bet you've seen a lot of changes in your field just over the years. I mean, the basic problem remains the same, but it sounds like you know, there's been a lot of changes within.
Well, the thing that's exciting is that we have improve the techniques, but we've also better able to pick which patients are going to succeed. And coming down the road within the next 2 or 3 years will be techniques that will be able to pick out which embryo is going to implant and do well and which one won't. In fact, we're just this week starting a new procedure that may allow us up to 67% implantation rate per embryo that we transfer back. And again, when we see these kinds of improvements, we're going to be transferring fewer embryos. So compared to ovulation or the simple, quote, cheaper treatments, the IVF may be more cost effective because of the improved success rate and lower risk of multiple births. So I think businesses and insurance companies who choose not to cover IVF may be shooting themselves in the foot because the employee is going to spend more time with treatment.
Now,
and have
did your organization come up with this these techniques or your?
No, we're partnering with various research programs in terms of the genetic basis for this new technology. We'll be one of the first in Atlanta. We're the first in Atlanta with the new financial program. We call it Making IVF Affordable Plan. Mm-hmm. Because it really does open the door to couples who haven't been able to do this before.
If we have listeners that do suffer from infertility and would love to have children and they're thinking about approaching this, I understand you do a complimentary consultation. Can you walk us through that process?
Well, the first and best thing to do is to go to our website, IVF.com, to learn about the practice, to read the information. We have a monthly seminar about IVF and infertility, and people can attend that. And that's good because they get an idea of all the steps that are involved and how they might fit in, and they can ask questions. We also offer a 15 to 20 minute free visit. It's a get acquainted visit to see if we're the right practice, if beginning the process makes sense for them, and we'll sit down and offer that. And they just call the office if that's what they want to do. Now, if they actually want to get started in treatment, they should make a regular visit.
Sure, absolutely. And how long does a treatment typically last?
Well, it really depends what's going on. Usually by 4 to 6 weeks, we can have all the initial testing and kind of point someone in a direction and give them an idea about what it's going to take to help them achieve a family. The problem is that financial resources aren't always there.
Right. It sounds like what the, you know, the plan that you've come up with does make it affordable and makes it at least something that people can consider.
Well, we're excited. In the past, people with insurance were guaranteed access or at least some access to try these techniques if their insurance company covered it. And those insurance companies actually pay a fraction of the cost of the actual treatment. And we were covering the freight by having the self-pay patients pay more money, and it just didn't make sense to me. So we're trying to bring some equity into that so everybody gets access to treatment.
What percentage of insurance companies cover this?
Well, it's not an insurance company. Every company will have plans that provide coverage for IVF. It's really the place of work that decides we're going to cover this. Now, a typical insurance plan is going to be about roughly $500 to $600 a person per member per month. And the cost of having full infertility benefits in the plan is only an additional $2 per member per month. Mm. When you figure that you have the safety of not having, being able to reduce multiple births, not having the patient miss as much work, it makes sense to do the right thing.
Any final thoughts you want to leave our listeners? I understand it is just the patient-oriented medical care that you give is outstanding, and your willingness to work with families and showing your continued support, even though there might be tough times economically. Any other final thoughts?
Well, what we've a brochure that really explains to companies why this may be beneficial and in the long run costs them very little to provide full infertility coverage to their employees. And if people want the brochure, they can call our office and we'll mail out a copy, and they can do the legwork getting into the HR people. If any person listening is an HR person, we'd be glad to come meet with them and discuss why this makes sense for them and their own business.
Right. So you educate the HR person.
I think that's really what we have to do, because the present policies are actually costing them more at times.
Yeah, and that's one thing to consider, too. I don't think that every HR director understands that. Wonderful. Give us your phone number and your website one more time.
Our website is www.ivf.com. And the phone number is 404-843-2229, 404-843-2229.
Terrific. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Amy.
We hope people will reach out and check out your website. It has a lot of information. And who knows, maybe we'll have some new babies in the making, some new Atlanta Business Radio Show listeners soon.
We'll have to post the pictures on your website.
Maybe they'll name it after you.
Dr. Perlow?
No, you, Amy.
No, I don't think so. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Also up next, we have Dr. Elena George from Peachtree ENT. Welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show.
Thank you, Amy. It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell us, how long have you been practicing? Where are you from? Tell us a little bit about your practice.
I'm initially from New York. That's where I trained. And I moved to Atlanta back in 1998. I've been in solo practice since 2001. And my office is located in the Buckhead area, a couple blocks south of Piedmont Hospital.
So I understand you have a minimally invasive surgery for snoring. My goodness.
Yep.
Snoring is a big issue.
It's a huge issue. There's something called radiofrequency surgery. It's called a coblator, which means cold ablation. And this uses a technique where you're using a radio wave with the energy equivalent of 30 degrees, as opposed to a laser, which is about 4,000 degrees, and you literally emulsify the tissue so that you can shrink the tissue and give the person more airway, a larger airway from which to breathe. It's an office procedure, and it's a lot faster recovery than in the old days where it would take a month to recover. Now it takes about 10 days.
Is snoring a big problem? Is that pervasive?
It's one of the main things that an ear, nose, and throat doctor will see. Unfortunately, living in a society where people are seem to be gaining weight rapidly, and weight gain and all sorts of other issues lead to snoring as we get older. So it's a big player there.
Is sleep apnea another one of the issues that affect overweight people?
It can. You don't necessarily have to be overweight to have sleep apnea, but it is one of the main risk factors. Sleep apnea causes a lot of problems with our society. Anything from car accidents to children being diagnosed with ADD to adults not being able to concentrate at work, so the work productivity drops down.
Is it from the sleep apnea or from the lack of sleep that apnea is causing?
Well, there's actually two ways to think about this. There's snoring and there's sleep apnea. Snoring is simply noise. You're still sleeping well. You're sleeping deeply. You wake up refreshed.
It's just affecting the people around you.
Yeah, you're just bothering everybody in the room.
The companion.
Exactly. And sleep apnea is actually a physiological change. There's a stress on the body. The oxygen level drops to such a degree that the heart and the brain really struggle. Mm-hmm. And it leads to high blood pressure, obesity, diabetes, and even stroke. So there's a lot of different outgrowths from sleep apnea.
What are the symptoms of that?
You know, they're kind of hard to determine. That's why you need a sleep study. Mm-hmm. You can be sleepy in the daytime, have problems with mood, and be depressed, or flip side, have a very short fuse, have the inability to really concentrate, and your memory will change. And on a physiological standpoint, you have things like high blood pressure for no reason, or problems with irregular heartbeat for some patients. So you can end up in the doctor's office for different reasons, but the crux of it is really you're not sleeping well. So you tend to eat more during the day, maybe some more sugar, lots of caffeine, things to prop yourself up, and that can lead to other medical problems down the road.
I'm curious, do all people that have sleep apnea, do they snore?
For the most part, yes.
Okay, but not all snorers have sleep apnea.
That's absolutely right.
Okay, so some folks that snore would benefit from the treatment you were talking about earlier.
That's correct. And even those with sleep apnea.
Okay, interesting.
Because there's different reasons to snore. From an ENT point of view, it's about the anatomy. So if you're not able to move air well because your nose is congested, your septum, which is the bone that separates the left and right side of your nose, is deviated or bent to one side. If you've got a really large tongue or a soft palate, the little uvula that hangs down is really long and floppy. Those things can be corrected, and you can open up the airway.
What about sleep position?
Definitely. Sleeping on your side, sleeping on your stomach, sleeping or having pillows to make sure you can't roll onto your back.
Mm-hmm.
Or those are things that you can do, and you can lose weight. That's another thing you can do. And not drink any alcohol late in the evening.
So if you are a snorer, you should be sleeping on which way? On your back?
Or it depends. If you have a deviated septum, you want to sleep on the side that the septum is deviated to.
Uh-huh.
And basically people find their level. So I had a gentleman to come in yesterday telling me he sleeps on his stomach on the right side because that's the best way for him to get his sleep. Any other position,
can't work.
Do it right.
Because when someone snores, they actually wake up. I mean, my husband's a snorer. Gosh, all the listeners now know that. And you know, I've suffered from lack of sleep because of his snoring to the point where I took Ambien. And then, you know, that's a problem in and of itself. So not only is the snoring a problem for the person snoring, but the companion as well.
Agreed.
But I know he wakes himself up snoring because it's so loud.
It's a problem because he's not getting good quality sleeps. By the time he enters REM, which is a certain... You have to get a certain percentage of REM sleep per night to actually to have a restorative sleep. Otherwise, you're just closing your eyes.
Mm-hmm.
So every time he probably drops into something deep, he wakes himself up. So his quality of sleep is really compromised.
I think he needs to come see you.
I'd love to see you.
Now, if you have sleep apnea, how do you cure it? Do you have to do that procedure you mentioned? Does that get rid of it?
My approach to my practice is not one size fits all.
Sure.
So the person has to be evaluated, and that means taking a thorough history, finding out when they started snoring. There's different parameters you're looking for. Was this going on since you were 2, and it's just continued to your 25 or so?
Right.
Did it just start after you picked up 10 pounds?
Mm-hmm.
Did it start after you moved to Atlanta and started having allergy symptoms?
Sure.
So you have to figure out the root cause and then treat the problem, not just the symptom.
Now, do you work with those sleep study places?
Mm-hmm.
Or
absolutely. And there's actually at-home sleep studies now for those people who can't seem to fall asleep in a foreign bed and have all these wires stuck to their face and et cetera. So you can now do it at home, and that's really nice because it's a much more cost-effective approach. And for the patient, you don't have to give them Ambien or something to help them sleep to calm them down because they're not in their natural environment.
Right.
I like your approach, too. It's more about wellness rather than just jumping to
absolutely,
you know, a surgery or jumping to some kind of medication. So you walk us through. Say you have a patient that comes to you and obviously is very overweight and complains of snoring. Would you coach them on their diet or tell us what you might do for them?
After a thorough history and the physical exam, if I felt on the exam that the weight, and you can tell when you examine somebody, whether the weight is an issue versus a septum or their uvula, something that's surgical, absolutely we talk about weight loss. And that means changing their mindset about what they're eating and why they're eating it. I truly believe that, you know, the art of medicine has been lost. And there's no time that doctors spend with their patients. They don't have the time to do so. So it's I find that some practices have a one-minute visit with a doctor, it's a prescription, and they're out the door. I don't do that. I don't have medical extenders. I see all of my patients. I answer my phone calls after hours. It's very much old-fashioned technique here. So if it takes 40 minutes, an hour, to do the initial consultation, then it takes that. I don't double or triple book either. So the person has the time, and it's actually blocked into the system.
Mm-hmm.
So just the fact that you get to know your patient puts you ahead of the game, because when I trained, the theory was you make your diagnosis after you've done your history. I mean, the history is you're just confirming it with the physical exam, but you pretty much know what's going on after you've actually gotten to know the patient, and that's exactly how I approach it.
And you, it seems like you take a kind of a holistic approach first.
It's about wellness, and it's right. about integration. If I wanted to operate on everybody that walked through my door, I certainly could do that.
Sure.
But that's not what I'm about.
Right.
It's about treating the patient, the whole patient.
Mm-hmm.
And it works. You know, I'm not, if it's not broken, you know,
right.
don't try to fix it. It works great for me. And that means I have time to find the answer. If that means doing a culture before I start an antibiotic, that's what I do.
Mm-hmm.
If that means giving them medical management before we start talking about something surgical, that's the approach I want to take. It's no touch first. And then if you have to do surgery, by all means, then you need it. But then the outcomes are much better.
And what is the success rate?
For a sleep apnea?
Yeah.
In my practice, I'm sure I'm above the average. I would say about 85-90%. And actually, the people who failed are ones that have actually picked up weight after the surgery.
Right. It's that. So it's that connected to weight?
For it can be.
It can be.
So, you know, if you're 20, 30 pounds overweight, you generally tend to snore.
Uh-huh.
So my patient population, who I operate on, I pick very carefully. So mm-hmm. it's an anatomical reason that they're going in there. So the anatomical reason is corrected.
Mm-hmm.
If they put on 20,
right.
30 pounds after,
yes.
they're going to snore.
You can't help them.
No, no. Well, you try to tell them no more pork
right.
chops, but
right.
otherwise.
Right.
Excellent. Wow, what a refreshing view from a physician.
I
could listen to her all day,
really.
Lee. How can people reach you that want to know more?
They can call our office. It's 404-591-9100. And or reach us on the website. We actually like to have a lot of integrative approach here, so that means you can reach us by any means necessary. So if you go to our website, www.peachtreeentcenter.com, you can download the forms for seeing us. You can email me directly, and I will definitely email you back. It's about being able to contact me, because it's about communication.
Terrific. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
We hope our listeners will reach out, check out your website, and my goodness, I don't know of anybody that isn't affected by snoring. I really don't.
It's true.
I could see you're very personally involved in this, Amy.
I have personal involvement. Yes, I do. Thank you so much for being with us
today.
Thank
you so much.
You know, Lee, this is a great segue into our next guest, because it seems like what we're hearing more and more about is wellness. Gee, we do tend to take better care of ourselves and have a little bit more skin in the game when we have to, you know, pay for things. And when we talk about co-pays and deductibles and managed care, you have more skin in the game if you have to pay. And employers are looking more towards solutions of wellness. We heard from Dr. George talking about wellness. We're very privileged this morning to have with us Dr. David Rierick of Strategic Benefit Solutions. Welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show.
Good morning, Amy.
So this is just great, Doctor, because you're all about wellness. We're talking about wellness. Tell us your approach. You're a doctor. You left medicine to do what you're doing now. Walk us through that.
Well, yes, thank you. It's nice to be here. Good morning, Lee.
Good morning, Doctor.
My background is a little different, although I have to agree with both the earlier speakers today that it is all about wellness. I'm a family physician by training and was one of the early founders of what is now called the Wellstar Physicians Group here in Atlanta, but moved over to the dark side to become Aetna's medical director for the Southeast and learn the managed care side of medicine. The last 15 years of my life has really been working with organizations, primarily employers, helping them implement strategies to improve the health status of their populations as a long-term strategy to control their health care costs and improve worker productivity. And I think most employers now really realize that they hold the key to getting a lot of the population healthier today.
So walk our listeners through, because oftentimes people will think, okay, human resources, managed care, wellness, what does any of it have to do with each other? Walk us through that process. I mean, we can talk about, I just read an article, actually, I just opened this up from Fast Company. This just came in my mailbox yesterday, May of 2009. And it says here that healthcare accounts for one in every $6 spent in the United States, and that's climbing rapidly. Why? Why? And how can we help that with wellness?
There will be probably close to $2 trillion spent in America on the healthcare industry next year. It's a huge bill. And many of the things that are driving the cost of healthcare are out of one's control. it's very difficult for an employer to control the shifting of costs from the private to the public sector, to control the cost of technology, to control the demographics of the population. We're all getting older, and that means sicker. But there is one thing that they can control, and that is the health status of their population. You know, when I was a doctor and I was seeing diabetics and hypertensives, about all I could do was give them a 90-day prescription, tell them to lose weight, avoid salt, come back and see me and let me rant and rave. But as a benefit consultant, I can implement health and wellness incentive programs, tie them to their benefit plan, and really change lifestyles.
Can you explain how that works? Because that, I think, is really the critical element of this, and that and it's, as you say, that that's what makes this work, as opposed to when an individual, like you, your previous patient from back in the day, and you said, you know, eat less and exercise more, and they're like, yeah, doc, whatever, and then they'd come back in 90 days and their behavior really didn't change. Now you have kind of a mechanism that can really impact actual change. Can you share how that works?
Sure. Be glad to, Lee. In our firm, I think we have a particular competency in the area of health improvement. Backing me up is Steve Cherniak, who used to run all Ford Motor Company's health and wellness programs for 20-plus years. And we have a staff that understands this concept. We integrate, by use of carrots and sticks, health incentives into the benefit program. So for an example, maybe the first year we make it mandatory that an employee who wants to have health benefits must complete a health risk assessment. All they have to do is fill out the form. Their answers, of course, will never be shared with the employer. That's protected by, you know, ERISA and HIPAA law. The second year, they may be paid an incentive to engage in voluntary biometric testing.
Based on those kind of results that you saw from their history, right?
That's right.
So it would be customized to each individual?
Absolutely. And we offer programs through various health and wellness vendors that will provide private personalized counseling and outreach to members identified with health risks, such as elevated cholesterol and blood pressure and elevated BMI or not exercising properly, so that individuals can engage privately, telephonically, or sometimes even in person if we put somebody inside the organization to get the kind of counseling that physicians today really don't have the time to give their patients.
And it's so true. We spend half of our waking hours at work. For your employer to take a vested interest in your wellness, providing, you know, healthy resources or healthy snacks in the vending machine. I mean, there's so many basic things that an employer can provide. Walk us through maybe a success story, a company that you've worked with, and how they may have seen their employee population become healthier.
Sure. We have lots of those, even in the Atlanta area. We have municipalities. I think a very good example, and I'm sure they wouldn't mind me mentioning them, is the city of Fayetteville, who's had a wellness program now in their fourth year. It's mandatory for health risk assessments and they have voluntary biometric testing, and they have a very active wellness committee. They run many, you know, individually run programs throughout their organization, such as the Biggest Loser contest, Maintain Don't Gain contest over the holidays, and their population has consistently gotten healthier. The average risk factors that their employee population have has significantly decreased over the years, and their health care premiums have always been pretty well controlled, too.
So really, it comes back to that from an employer perspective. Being able to reduce those costs really reduces their bottom line and creates a healthier employee.
That's right.
What is it like when you're sharing this with a prospective client of yours? Like, are they open to this? Are they looking for any way they can save money? And do they understand, like, hey, this is something that I can save a ton of money if I implement a wellness program? That's an investment that's going to really pay me back over time.
I think we've reached the tipping point in this area. Most employers have really pushed the envelope on increasing copays, increasing deductibles to try to control their health care costs, and we're past that now. Most employers, irrespective of whether they're fully insured or self-funded and paying the bill themselves, realize that they must get their employees engaged in healthy lifestyle behavior and are ready to talk about this.
So it's finally at the point where it's in everybody's best interest to address this. We can no longer just leave it up to the individual to just on their own figure this out.
That's right. And, you know, we're all very human in our ability to change lifestyle. We all need a little carrot and stick to get us to move in the right direction.
Right.
And there's no better way that I've found than to integrate it into benefit design and give people incentives to do the right thing.
Absolutely. I totally agree. What a win-win situation. Is there a specific type of company that you like to work with? I mean, where do you start? How many employees?
Our firm focuses primarily in the middle market, and by that I mean most of our clients are between 150 employees up to 10,000. We don't deal in the giant companies, but you know, that mid-market is a segment that oftentimes doesn't get the expertise that we feel our firm has and can bring to that market segment.
Right. It's not the people don't work that size, right? They're either doing the super big or the individuals.
That's right.
Excellent. There's a lot to learn about this subject, and you definitely have a lot of knowledge to share. If people want to learn more, how can they find you?
Well, our website is also a good place to start, and that is S as in Sam, B as in boy, S as in Sam, -benefits with an S, .com, or they can certainly contact me directly, and my email is davr@sbs-benefits.com.
And on the website, there's a lot of information. They can get a lot of information just by browsing through the website, right?
Absolutely.
And people also need to check out your book.
Well, thank you for mentioning. Yeah. The book is Good Health, It's Good Business. It's an implementation guide for corporate wellness. And that was published last year, and it's been received very well. We're in our second printing. It is basically a book written for HR professionals to help them get started in a health and wellness culture.
Terrific. Thank you so much for being our guest today. We hope our listeners will reach out. And, you know, maybe we need a Biggest Loser challenge as part of the Atlanta Business Radio Show. Yeah, maybe.
For all the guests?
No, not for the guests, for the listeners. Maybe we need to engage them in some way. We got to think about that.
At our next meeting.
Yes, in our next wellness committee meeting.
Right.
Until next week, thank you so much for listening. I'm Amy Otto, and I hope you have a great week.